It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, no Maria again today.
No, she. Well, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission has her in for questioning, so hopefully she'll be back next week.
All right, we're keeping our fingers crossed.
Yeah, I had no idea she was into that insider trading stuff. Would have been the last person at it.
She built that knowledge up from somewhere. So
yeah, well.
All right. Let's get started with local and our state legislature is still in session.
Yeah, and of course, dangerous things happen when the state legislature is in session, and this year is no exception. They're trying to bridge an unprecedented amount of money that they need to account for in the state budget because of falling revenues due to the economic downturn. And although the budgets that were provided by both the House and the Senate contained only cuts and rather dramatic cuts, there's now a movement within the state legislature, and particularly Democratic Party leaders in both the House and the Senate, with the exception of Senator Lisa Brown, who we talked about the last couple of weeks, and we'll talk about it again in a moment. But there's according to House Speaker Frank Chop, there's now better than a 50-50 chance that there will be a sales tax measure on this year's ballot. Now, that won't affect the budget for the first part of the two-year biennium, of course. But the problem with this is that the sales tax is by far the most regressive of the possibilities for trying to raise revenue to help bridge this gap. Now, Lisa Brown, who we mentioned a moment ago, had floated a proposal which had been backed by Senator Gene Cole Wells and a few other people to broach the idea of having a so-called high income tax. That is to say, introducing a state income tax for people earning over a certain amount. The suggestion by Lisa Brown was basically a millionaire's tax, but and I think in actuality it was over $500,000 people would be paying an income tax. And it would probably need to be a lower threshold than that in order to put a really significant debt in the budget. But again, once again, this is part of a structural inequality in the state budget and in the state's economy, wherein because so much of the income for the state is pegged onto a sales tax and pegged onto property tax, the sales tax only applies to a certain portion of the economy. In other words, retail consumer goods that are sold. That's been a steadily declining share of the economy over the last several decades. So that all other things being equal, you're going to get a steady long-term decline in the amount of money as a percentage of the economy that the state has available to do its business. Above and beyond that, it's much more vulnerable to disruptions like the one we're seeing now during economic downturns and, you know, deceptively good times during economic boom times. So this is really the idea of putting a sales tax on the ballot. Not only is it going to be politically unpopular, but it should be politically unpopular because it impacts the most number of people who can least afford it. That is to say, sales taxes as a percentage, again, of income disproportionately impact the poor and working class and the middle class as opposed to the wealthy who spend much less of the money they take in on taxable items. So this is what the state is talking about doing. In another arena, they're also talking about putting a heavier share of the burden on people who can afford to pay more. That is the proposals about what to do about funding for higher education, which takes a huge hit in especially the House version, but also the Senate version of the budgets that they're trying to craft. And in response to this, they've suggested a huge hike in the state tuition, something like 30%. But this again is flying in the face of something that would be fairer and probably have less of an impact on the poor and working class, and that is to raise the tuition even higher, but to use that extra income to provide scholarships and grants for that are means tested, so that and this is something that private universities have been doing for decades. The schools that have, you know, a much higher percentage of or a much higher tuition costs, you know, the Stanfords and Ivy League schools of the world, and this has been spreading to public universities over the last decades or so, as even the cost of a public college education has gotten much, much higher. But in this state, we don't do that yet. And we're talking about, even though having a massive tuition increase looks like it's going to be necessary, they're not including the money or the proposal for enabling the poor and middle class to actually pay for that by increasing the amount of tuition and scholarship money, or grant and scholarship money that's available. So once again, we see a proposal coming out of Olympia where the burden is placed disproportionately on the people who can at least afford to do it, in this case, cutting off access to higher education. And this is coming from our so-called democratic leadership, the people who are, you know, supposedly representing the less affluent in our society. It makes you wonder who they're really representing instead.
All right. Moving on, Microsoft getting some bad news this week.
Yeah, speaking of people that they're probably representing instead, the German court found that Microsoft, that fined Microsoft, rather, 9 million euros, that's about $11 million, for price fixing in Europe, where they were conspiring with retailers to fix the price of one of its products. This, again, points up a difference between the EU and the United States. They seem to have antitrust legislation over there is something that they actually get this actually in force, as though it's actually on the books and means something. Yeah, who knew? I guess if they did something like that in the United States sometime.
All right, and with this being an election year, the King County Executive has another hat in the ring.
Yeah, we already had three Democrats running for the King County Executive to replace Ron Sims, who's taken off for the Obama administration. Now we have our first Republican, Susan Hutchinson, who's a former news anchor for Cairo TV. She's been in the private sector for the last few years, actually running a very large nonprofit that that dispenses grants, but now she wants to run for King County Executive. Well, who is Susan Hutchinson, you might ask, in addition to trying to cash in on this region's seemingly unique penchant for trying to elect media representatives and you know, people with high profile celebrity names to positions of political power? We had Charlie Royer, we had Jim Compton, we've had just Gene Godden, now we have James Donaldson, the former Sonic, running for mayor. Now we have Susan Hutchinson running for King County Executive. Well, she's an extremely conservative former TV news anchor. In fact, she's been on the board of the Discovery Institute. That they're best known, of course, for being the national leaders in promoting the idea of an intelligent, so-called intelligent design, as an alternative to the theory of evolution, which is actually, you know, pretty widely accepted by most of the here's that word again, intelligent world. But Susan Hutchinson, in other words, comes from that branch of sort of aggressively, proudly ignorant Christianity that would prefer to turn its back on scientific evidence. And she is running for King County Executive, which ought to run send chills down anybody's spine, particularly because she is the only Republican now running for that race, as opposed to three Democrats. So you could conceivably see them splitting their votes and leaving her with much of the conservative electorate to claim as her own. Now, it was very interesting that the Seattle Times, in its coverage of this announcement, and of course the Times now being our only daily newspaper in the area and the only real media source that has any kind of comprehensive coverage of local politics, because let's face it, television news is something of a joke, they very much soft-pedaled Hutchinson's religious affiliations, noting only that she serves on the boards of several area nonprofits, but not caring to name what some of those nonprofits are.
All right.
Reminding us once again of what we lost when we no longer were a two newspaper town.
All right, moving on to national and developments with the Justice Department this week.
Yeah, It was not a good week for civil liberties. First of all, we had the Obama administration announcing that it's going to appeal a ruling that we talked about last week, that Bagram detainees, that is in the secret military camps in Afghanistan, have habeas corpus rights and due process rights. Now, you may remember the civil libertarians were all up in arms when the Bush administration originally announced that prisoners in the so-called war on terror do not have due process rights. Well, we no longer, at least technically, have the global war on terror. But we do have the precedent that that was set, even though we now have a Democratic president. The Obama campaigned against a lot of those various civil liberty infringements, but now his administration is making exactly the same arguments in court. This is the third case in a row over the last 3 months where the Obama administration has essentially used the claim of state secrets and its claimed necessity of the ability to do whatever it wants with prisoners that it gets in the war on terror in order to upend the Constitution, basically. And we had another instance of it this week also. The Justice Department filing a motion last Friday in an Electronic Freedom Foundation lawsuit against warrantless wiretapping, where the government, in the guise of the Obama administration's Department of Justice, basically said this suit needs to be thrown out. It filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit entirely under the grounds that involve state secrets. That was exactly the policy by which the Bush administration blocked different lawsuits and attempts to bring it to justice filed in the civil courts by claiming that the courts didn't have jurisdiction because, quite frankly, anything the government did couldn't be adjudicated in the courts because the government, its national security requirements essentially placed it above the law, that anything the president or the administration did was legal as long as it could possibly be argued that it involved national security, because we can't have anything like that coming out in court, even though it's been widely reported all around the world. Well, the Obama administration, after Obama campaigned against those kind of arguments, is making exactly the same kind of arguments in court. It's very, very alarming and discouraging.
All right. And I know if people want to get more details on that particular one, they can go to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's website, EFF.org, and they have a lot of documentation on that ongoing case.
Yeah, the Talking Points memo has also had a lot of very good information and analysis on the case, too.
All right. Moving on, the Treasury Department coming out with some news this week.
Yeah, the annual budget deficit, and maybe now isn't the time to be worried about the budget deficit, but yeah, you probably still should be. For 2009, that is the first 6 months of one calendar year, the budget deficit for the federal government is nearly $1 trillion. That went up dramatically in March. Nearly $200 billion of that came in March, which is much more than economists were expecting. A lot of that coming to do with the bailout, but also a lot of it has to do with falling revenues due to the economic downturn. So this is something that in the coming months the government is going to have to deal with, the conflict between the massive amount of money that is particularly being poured into the financial sector by the Treasury Department and the fact that the budget deficit has got a huge gaping hole in it at this point that's going to have to be paid by, you know, our kids, our grandkids, their grandkids, and so forth.
All right. Excuse me. Moving on to international and the climate change conference that we didn't hear about.
Yeah, there was a conference in Germany this past week of leaders around the world trying to talk about climate change and what it is that could be done. And they were really looking toward the United States and the incoming Obama administration to once again reverse some of the legacies of the Bush administration, where it was very much played an obstructionist role trying to keep it from reaching any kind of agreement and try to take some leadership on the issue instead. Well, the Obama administration, to its credit, is not the obstructionist that the United States was under Bush, but it still didn't take much of a leadership role. In fact, a lot of the international players at the conference in Germany were really quite surprised by how cautious the Obama administration is being on climate change. And we've seen that in domestic legislation, too, where when Congress gutted the Obama administration's cap and trade proposals, which really aren't even the best way to approach climate change compared to, say, a carbon tax. But even the relatively modest cap and trade proposals that the Bush administration put into it, or the Obama administration rather, put into its budget, were gutted by Congress. And you really didn't see the Obama administration fight for those the way, for instance, that it's fought for some of the health care provisions that it put into the budget. We've seen also where a number of high level appointments and sub-cabinet appointments on areas having to do with climate change haven't been filled yet. There's still vacancies within the government, which is kind of surprising. But we're also seeing another key area where not much has happened on climate change so far is the EPA, which was empowered by a Supreme Court ruling last year to enforce greenhouse gases as a pollutant. The EPA basically is waiting for Congress to do something rather than going ahead and enforcing that as it was empowered to by the courts. So we're seeing on a number of fronts at this point, this conference in Germany only being the latest example, that the Bush administration has been pretty slow going when
Obama,
it comes to climate change.
You did a slip there again.
Obama. I'm sorry. I don't know why I keep confusing him with Bush today.
About that some, before we went on the air.
Yeah, it seems to be, I don't know, deja vu. But we're seeing the Obama administration being really very, very cautious when it comes to climate change. And some of that is due to how much energy the Obama administration has had to put into dealing with the economic crisis instead. Some of it has to do with the economic crisis itself, because of fears that they don't want to further damage the economy in a time of economic downturn. But nonetheless, you know, the biosphere and the atmosphere and the planet really don't care whether humans are in an economic downturn or not. They're going to keep cooking the planet until we do something to stop it. Doing something to stop it really can't wait for us to have a robust economy first.
Well, moving on, perhaps one of the solutions to global warming is nuclear winter.
Yeah, that would be a possibility. Obama was in Prague this week also, giving a what was billed as a very, very historic speech on the topic of nuclear weapons. Obama calling for essentially the abolition of nuclear weapons in a nuclear-free world. This is all wonderful and all well and good, but what a lot of the media coverage on this didn't acknowledge is that the United States actually, that has been its official position for at least going back to Reagan for at least the last two decades, that the United States, or even before that, the United States has been a signatory to treaties that call for the eventual abolition of nuclear weapons, and of course has done little or nothing to try and make that an eventuality, whether in regard to our own nuclear arsenal, well, which is enormous, or in regard to trying to stop nuclear proliferation around the world, especially by our friends, countries like Israel and India and Pakistan. So it'll be very interesting to see once again whether Obama's actions match his rhetoric. The rhetoric is all very well and fine and good and inspiring, and having a world without nuclear weapons is certainly a very positive thing, particularly since we have by far the largest arsenal and it costs a huge amount of money to maintain it every year and to keep manufacturing these things. But that needs to be translated into policy to back it up. And it will also be interesting to see if that policy is matched by any kind of a commitment to clean up the mess that's been made by the production of the nuclear industry that has had over the last 60 years. And that's true in Hanford, and it's true at a number of toxic nuclear sites around the country.
Yeah, I know. They just had a big job fair over at Hanford this last week. I think like 1,000 jobs or...
Yeah, and of course, especially with the economy, there was a huge turnout for it.
Now, I saw in the news that one of the first things that was mentioned at this particular meeting about the reduction of nuclear weapons was they're talking a reduction of around 1,500 warheads, both with the Russia and the U.S. But if I remember correctly, that was about the same number that during the Bush administration they had proposed reducing as well. So it didn't seem, you know, like an over aggressive move.
No, it really wasn't. And of course, these again are proposals. They need to be matched by a commitment to actually negotiate to make it happen. Now, this is a particularly key time for nuclear proliferation because the START treaty that allegedly controls the spread of nuclear weapons, particularly between the United States and Russia, that's due to expire in June of 2010, and the Bush administration did nothing to start the negotiations for replacing or extending that treaty. That needs to happen, and it needs to happen now. So hopefully coming out of this meeting in Prague, those negotiations will be jump-started.
Well, and then finally, during the Bush administration, it was multiple bilateral agreements, especially with nuclear weapons, that the U.S. had backed out of. So did you hear anything this week that would indicate that the U.S. is looking at getting back into those agreements?
No, and there also wasn't anything, at least not that I saw, that involved the United States finally becoming a signatory to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which again, the Bush administration backed out of over the last 8 years.
All right. Moving on next to Afghanistan.
Yeah, big political controversy within Afghanistan this week, and don't forget this is a venue where the United States has dedicated itself to pouring in massive new amounts of money and troops in order to support the government there. The Afghan Parliament passed and Karzai signed into law this last week. A law which should send chills down anybody's spine, frankly. It ostensibly has to do with the rights of Shia women, Shiites being a minority that composes about 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The majority is Sunni there, and that includes the Taliban, who were Sunni and the religious extremists. But the Shiites have other religious extremists as well, and this was a law that was dedicated to apparently to pandering to them, particularly with a presidential election coming up in August. It's a law about the rights of women that basically gave all of their rights to the men in their lives, including that women cannot leave the house without a husband's permission. They must submit to the sexual demands of their husbands, quote, unless they are ill or menstruating. Fathers can order daughters to marry the people of his choosing, including at a very young age, and on and on and on. They basically turn Shiite women into abject slaves to the men in their lives. And there's really something of an uproar over this, which is encouraging in itself. Several cabinet members have been among the leaders who have signed protest statements about this law. But remember, this is the kind of extremely fundamentalist oriented government that ostensibly we went in and overthrew the Taliban in order to avoid, and now we're seeing it happen again. We've seen this over a number of years with the rights of women steadily declining post-occupation while the United States presumably had extremely large influence in the affairs of Afghanistan, but this is the most extreme example yet, and it's very, very troubling.
All right, and finally, events in Thailand.
Yeah, big protests in Thailand this week, which ought to give a certain warmness in the heart to anybody who remembers the WTO protests here 10 years ago. Protesters at a Southeast Asian summit there basically shut down the convention. They overran the convention center and were literally roaming through the halls, occupying the place and demanding the resignation of Thailand's government. Now, this has a couple of different sources to it. It goes back to the military coup in late 2005 that overthrew the popularly elected and somewhat populist prime minister who was in power then. And it also has to do with the economic crisis, as was mentioned in Counterspin earlier this hour. That economic crisis has been impacting developing countries and poorer economies much more starkly than it has countries here in the developed world, even though we we were the ones who started it, basically. And we're seeing in countries where the economic elite and conservatives are running the country that it affects the poor of those countries much more starkly than it does to the well-to-do. So we're starting to see protests about that sort of thing around the world, and this was the most dramatic example yet.
All right. And events for this week?
Several of them. 11 o'clock this morning, speaking of the economic crisis, a New Way Forward protest here, part of a day of protests around the country against Wall Street and against bailouts to Wall Street. There'll be a march starting with an 11 o'clock rally at Victor Steinbrück Park, now down by Pike Place Market. This afternoon, a workshop from 3 to 5 o'clock on war tax resistance. If you want to find out more about conscientious objection to paying money for military and all those nuclear weapons and so forth, that'll be from 3 to 5 o'clock at University Friends Meeting, 40th and 9th Avenue Northeast in the University District. And all this weekend, Honkfest, which for those of you that didn't go to the first annual Honkfest last year, it's a blast. It's basically concerts of acoustic percussion bands. So people like the Infernal Noise Brigade, the Anti-Fascist Marching Band, and so forth. Groups like that from all over the country are here in Seattle this weekend. Well worth checking out at venues around the city.
All right. Talking with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is a fine local compilation of activist events and news and opinion and humor put together by volunteers. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org, as well as wherever you find free publications at bookstores, coffee shops, King County Library System, and so forth. And because it is an all-volunteer publication, we are in the midst of a fund drive to keep having the operating capital to print this year, and if you can help out with that, we would very much appreciate it. We actually have this will sound familiar to listeners to public radio, we have a matching grant on the table. Somebody who is willing to match any contribution of $100 or more up to $500. So if you can afford that kind of money, send it in, and that will be doubled by a very generous anonymous donor. But really, any amount that you can give helps us out quite a bit. You can go to our website at www.eatthestate.org and donate there, or you can send checks or money orders or cash, gold coins, whatever, to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you'd like to find out more about ETS or have comments or tips on anything you heard on the show, you can email us at info@eatthestate.org, or give a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.